We knew this was going to be a struggle. I think it's a 50-50 proposition. The outcome of the Senate could go either way.
If Joe Biden's president and Mitch McConnell is majority leader, it's an instant constitutional crisis.
Tomorrow is it. The end of voting. The White House up for grabs, of course, but so too is the United States Senate. Connecticut Senator Democrat Chris Murphy doesn't have to run for re-election this year, but he's been actively fundraising for Democrats.
If you want to sort of come up with a reason why it's so important to get a Democratic Senate and Joe Biden in the White House, it's because we will much more expeditiously pass anti-coronavirus legislation if Joe Biden has a partner to work with in the Senate, rather than having to fight against Mitch McConnell on healthcare legislation.
We spoke with Murphy on Friday night. We also requested interviews with 12 Republican senators, all committee chairmen or in other leadership positions, including the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. All Republican senators either declined or did not respond to our requests. McConnell, however, has been speaking to other outlets, namely Fox News, about what he thinks is at stake for the Senate. And here's what he told Fox in September.
They will get rid of the filibuster in the Senate, thereby eliminating the potential for any serious opposition. They'll admit the District of Columbia is a state and Puerto Rico is a state, giving them four new Democratic senators in perpetuity. They'll pack the Supreme Court, the circuit courts, the district courts, and then they'll turn to the economy. They'll overregulate and overtax like they always do, and America won't look 2 years later like it does today.
America won't look like it does today. That is McConnell's rallying cry to Republicans.
They need to be stopped. The Senate is the firewall against that sort of thing. And that's what's at stake for the American people if they choose to go in the other direction and give the Democrats the entire government.
As for Democrats, Murphy says take McConnell at his word. The GOP would stop any efforts by a Biden administration should the former vice president win the White House. That is Chris Murphy's rallying cry for Democrats.
Mitch McConnell will stand in the way of everything, every single one of his cabinet members, his climate agenda, his democracy agenda, his health care agenda. Joe Biden simply can't actually activate the mandate that he'll be given without a Democratic Senate.
So from NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today on Point, currently there is a 53-47 Republican-Democrat split in the Senate, 35 seats up for grabs right now. So we're going to take a look at some of the close races around the country and why the balance of power in the chamber will determine the direction of governance in this country for the next 4 years. And we're going to start with Anthony Brooks. He's On Point's 2020 correspondent and senior political reporter for WBUR. Hello there, Anthony.
Hi, Meghna. Good to talk to you.
And happy election eve. We made it.
Yes, almost.
Almost. Almost. The country's almost there. And who knows what's going to happen after Tuesday anyway. So let me just first get a sense from you about your take on the fact that the Senate is up for grabs in terms of Republican or Democratic control.
Yeah, I mean, this obviously, after the race for the White House, is the thing that everybody's focused on. And just to bring all listeners up to date, as you mentioned, Meghna, Republicans hold a 53-47 majority. So if Biden wins, they need to net three seats to guarantee a Senate majority. They're expected to lose Alabama. Mm-hmm. Doug Jones is probably going to go down there. He won that special election a couple of years back. So that means they have to win four races. Colorado and Arizona look like the likeliest, followed by Maine and North Carolina, which is still a bit of a coin flip. But those are the four likeliest states to give Democrats what they're hoping to get. And it's striking, Meghna. I mean, the sort of numbers that I'm looking at are it's just the amount of money that's been spent in these races. I mean, $100 million in Maine. Right. I mean, you know Maine, these yeah. two very small media markets. Montana, $120 million. And North Carolina, the most expensive Senate contest ever, $200 million. So that gives you a sense of what the folks who are funding these races think is at stake here.
Wow. Now, the GOP won the majority back in 2014, right? There was that surge of Republican senators. Do I have that right?
That's right.
Okay. And so why now does it seem as if the balance of power is up for grabs? I mean, what's causing the potential shift here?
Well, two things. I mean, there's a structural reason, and that is, every election cycle, one party or the other has more seats to lose, and this is the Republicans' turn. There are a lot more Republican seats in play than Democratic seats. And then, quite honestly, you've got the Donald Trump factor. He's not a popular president, and he's a drag on a lot of these Republican seats. So, I mean, let's look at Maine just for an example. Susan Collins, the Republican incumbent, successfully presented herself for years as a moderate. In 2014, she was able to win the support of almost 40% of Democrats, 72% of those who described themselves as moderates. But now we're in the age of Trump, and it's polarizing, and it's taken a real toll on Collins' reputation as an independent. She lost lots of liberal support when she voted to confirm Justice Brett Kavanaugh. She supported the GOP tax bill. That alienated lots of liberals and lots of moderates. And she refused to denounce President Trump, and she voted to acquit him in the Senate impeachment trial. So her reputation as a moderate, as someone who can work across party lines, has really taken a hit. Mm. And so Sarah Gideon is now polling ahead of her. There's a gender gap. Collins has the support of only 33% of women. Gideon has 54%. So that's just an example. One more statistics. Moderates, people who self-identify as independents, are turning away from Collins as well. So that's just an example of the polarization of the Trump era that has hurt a Republican upon whom control of the Senate could pivot.
Wow. Well, Anthony, we're going to spend the rest of the hour touching down on three states where the Senate races are very close. So I want you to sort of ride along with me here.
Happy to do it.
We're going to hear from South Carolina, Iowa, and Georgia. So let's start in South Carolina in that race between incumbent Republican Senator Lindsey Graham and Democrat Jamie Harrison. Here's Graham on Fox News last Saturday.
You know, my opponents raised $109 million to take me out. They want the Senate so badly. They're trying to destroy this president who's had the best presidency since Ronald Reagan. So help me. I'm up here fighting for Amy, Judge. I'm not going home till we get her on the court.
And here is Democrat Jamie Harrison making his case on CNN last week.
If you listen to the rhetoric of Lindsey Graham right now, Lindsey Graham is trying to scare people to support him. I'm trying to inspire people to support me. That's a very different contrast. And in the end, I think hope is going to beat fear.
That was Jamie Harrison on CNN on last week. So joining us now from Columbia, South Carolina, is Gavin Jackson. He's a reporter with South Carolina Public Radio and also host of SCETV's weekly public affairs show, This Week in South Carolina, and also the weekly South Carolina Lead podcast. Gavin, it's great to have you back on the show.
Meghna, thanks for having me back. Happy Election Eve.
Happy Election Eve. So what's your headline right now in that South Carolina Senate race?
It's going to be close. That's what we can say for right now, definitively. Can't give you one way or another, but it's going to be close. That's something we've been watching this entire race, especially it really became closer and closer over the summer with the polling and the amount of money coming into this race. And, of course, with the Supreme Court confirmation process, that's really been just driving so much of the narrative of this race so far.
Okay, driving the narrative, and do you have a sense as to whose advantage? Because we heard that clip from Senator Graham just a second ago there, really pointing to exactly that. Has that rallied his potential voters in the state?
I would say most certainly. I mean, I can't think we can underestimate just how important this whole confirmation process was and the timing of it. Obviously in late September with the loss of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that really just set off such a huge chain of reaction, essentially, in events, and really kind of came at a time when Lindsey Graham needed to reinforce who he was to his base, to really rally them, to show them again what he does for them, and that is confirm, judges to the federal bench. And now in this case, obviously the Supreme Court. You know, the Kavanaugh hearing was just such a critical moment for Lindsey Graham in the first place, going from, Trump critic in 2016 to then, outspoken ally. And of course, going to bat for his his pick, Brett Kavanaugh, at the time, back in 2018. So this was another way for him to be front and center again, now Senate Judiciary Committee chairman, and just show them that he can do what he has said he's always been able to do, and that is to get these justices on the court. And that's something that he always kind of got a hard time for from some of his more ultra-conservative supporters. Maybe they're not necessarily his supporters, but maybe his defectors, because they didn't like the fact that he supported these Obama judges before. And they always painted him as too, you know, wishy-washy, too squishy on that, because he was willing to be bipartisan. That's the reason why he had six primary challengers in 2014. This time around, not so much the case, and he easily got the nomination this time around. So it's been interesting to watch, and of course the Supreme Court has been at the center of this as well.
Anthony, do you have a question for Gavin?
Yeah, I do. Gavin, good to talk to you. I'm just curious if you can talk a little bit about the importance of the black vote in South Carolina around this Senate race, because, of course, the black vote had so much to do with the fact that Joe Biden is the Democratic nominee. And I'm just I have to assume that that's a constituency you're watching with a lot of interest.
Mm-hmm. It definitely is. And that's something that, you know, needs to turn out. That the black vote needs to turn out in record numbers this go around. I mean, if you look back at previous elections, obviously we always look back at 2008 when we talk about presidential elections, and that was obviously one of our bigger turnout years. 2012, we had about 865,000 Democrats turn out, and obviously a big chunk of the Democratic electorate in South Carolina are African American voters, about 61% of that. So driving those folks to the polls has been a big motivator for Jamie Harrison. They've been going to different places, different towns. The state Democratic Party has been touching all the counties in the state to really rally people up. Again, super difficult to do in this pandemic era, but having a lot of money on hand, which Jamie Harrison does, has really been a big factor in getting people's attention and motivation.
Gavin, can you just stay with us over the bridge, over the break? Because I've got at least one more question for you about what South Carolina is telling us about the voter mindset. So can you stay with us?
Sure thing.
Okay, so Gavin Jackson and Anthony Brooks, stand by here. We are taking a look at the U.S. Senate up for grabs in 2020. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are taking a look at the United States Senate today because the balance of power for the Senate is up for grabs in the 2020 election. I'm joined today by Anthony Brooks. He's On Point's 2020 correspondent and senior political reporter for WBUR. Gavin Jackson is also with us from Columbia, South Carolina, a reporter for South Carolina Public Radio. We're taking a look at South Carolina, Iowa, and Georgia in particular today of the many close races that are going on in the Senate. And Gavin, the question that I had for you was, you know, Anthony was telling us a little bit earlier about the Trump factor in this race. And you did touch on this a little, but I wanted to hear a little more because I was looking at recent polling out of South Carolina, this from East Carolina University from October 28th, it looks like. And it has President Trump in the White House race up by a clear 7 points there. So I don't think anyone's expecting South Carolina to be close in the presidential race. But what is it telling you that it's so close in the Senate race? I mean, Senator Graham has really thrown his lot in with President Trump, and he's not necessarily getting a political edge off of that decision, even though there's clearly support for the president in the White House race in South Carolina.
Yeah, and Meghna, we're going to be one of the first states that call it for President Trump tomorrow, probably right after the polls close tomorrow at 7 p.m. That's going to be pretty obvious because we still are a solid red state. Yes, the Senate race is very different than what you would think in a state like South Carolina, but remember, we're not North Carolina, we're not Georgia when it comes to demographics in terms of voting turnout. I even spoke with our, you know, state Democratic Party chairman. And I said, you know, Trav, is our state turning purple? And he says, not yet. We're not at that stance yet. We're not North Carolina. We just haven't had, you know, a well done statewide Democratic campaign until obviously this one. And the big problem has always been money. And now this time around, you have Jamie Harrison, the Democrat in this race, who is going to bring in probably $140 million total when this race is over. He made headlines by raising $100 million. Senator Graham has now raised $100 million, he told the AP recently. And so we're thinking that Jamie Harrison's got about $140 million all said and done when this is done. So that money goes back towards the state party, too, to help with down-ballot candidates and help to start targeting those voters and identifying those folks that they can maybe peel off. And that's going to be the key thing there, Magna, is that, yes, you're going to have a lot of people voting for President Donald Trump. Republicans definitely support him still in this state. But you're going to be losing certain moderates in South Carolina that you maybe used to vote for Lindsey Graham that support him in the past, but say not this time around. You know, you've changed too much. You've become too flexible, you know, and we have such a better candidate this time around that, hey, maybe I'll give him a shot. You know, I've talked to people who used to support Graham, stayed with him for years, and then all of a sudden, you know, especially with the flip on the confirmation process and election year, was just like the straw that broke their back. And a lot of people are kind of getting tired. But at the same time, you can't underestimate the fact that he still has a solid base here. And again, going back to what he did for the president and getting Amy Coney Barrett confirmed and just other top priorities of the president getting pushed through with his support, that is a major appeal to a lot of people, especially ultra conservatives who are now coming back to Lindsey Graham as they maybe weren't before.
Gavin, I'm curious to ask you about health care, because, of course, that issue had so much to do with the Democrats flipping the House in 2018. And it seems like Lindsey Graham, and correct me if I'm wrong or just respond to this, there's a potentially perilous position for him. I mean, he gets a lot of credit for getting Amy Coney Barrett onto the Supreme Court, of course, but the Supreme Court is about to take up a challenge to the Affordable Care Act. And that's a potent issue for Democrats in many parts of the country. And I'm just wondering how it's playing out in South Carolina.
You know, that's something we have heard from the Democrats really kind of warning against having the support for Lindsey Graham. And these are the results of supporting someone like Senator Graham, because they're going to support these judges that can get rid of your health care and have long-term effects for you. But honestly, I wouldn't say it's become as much as it is on the national level. We don't hear as much about that. We hear a little bit more about fear mongering versus hope and trying to change things for the better in the state and to do other things like, you know, get COVID relief passed. I mean, that's something that, you know, Jamie Harrison has really been pushing for and slamming Lindsey Graham for, because he's saying he's too busy trying to confirm judges instead of trying to get a deal done on the relief package. So I think they are aware of it. And the pandemic has really brought a lot of the health challenges to light that they've talked about. But yes, I mean, Jamie Harrison is talking about it, but it's not necessarily, I think, as big of an issue as maybe on the national level.
Well, that's Gavin Jackson. He's a reporter for South Carolina Public Radio and host of the weekly South Carolina Lead podcast with us from Columbia. Gavin, thank you so very much, as always.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so that's the update from South Carolina. Let's hop over to Iowa now in the race between Senator Joni Ernst and Democratic candidate Teresa Greenfield. There was a senatorial debate in Iowa earlier this month. Some viral moments out of that debate when moderator Ron Steele asked both candidates about the price of different crops for Iowa farmers. His first question was for Democratic candidate Teresa Greenfield.
My question is a simple ag question. Teresa Greenfield, you answer first. What's the break-even price for a bushel of corn in Iowa this week?
Well, a bushel of corn's going for about $3.68 today, $3.69, and break-even really just depends on the amount of debt someone has. I suspect there's farmers that are breaking even at that price. However, if their yields are down 50%, that's certainly not going to cover it for them.
And then Steele asked incumbent Republican Senator Joni Ernst this.
What's the break-even price for soybeans in Iowa? You grew up on a farm. You should know this.
I think you had asked about corn, and
I asked her corn.
It depends on what the inputs are, but probably about $5.50.
Well, you're a couple dollars off, I think, here, because it's 10:05. So, well, we'll move on to something else then.
Well, joining us now from Des Moines is Breanne Fannin-Steele. She's chief politics reporter for the Des Moines Register. Breanne, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I do have to ask you about that one moment first, because in going back and watching the totality of the debate, there were a lot of technical difficulties during that debate where, you know, Greenfield actually couldn't hear questions for a lot of the time. And Ernst had said in that interaction a little bit later that she couldn't quite hear. I mean, do we know exactly what happened there?
It was an uncomfortable debate because there were so many technical glitches there. And so I think there is something to be said for the fact that there were technical glitches people couldn't quite hear. Both of our candidates were appearing remotely in that debate, by the way, because Joni Ernst was in Washington, D.C. to help with the confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett. And so both candidates appeared virtually. All of the moderators were there. It was a very 2020 kind of debate where things just went off the rails a little bit. So there's definitely something to be said there. But in the end, Joni Ernst didn't get it right, the question. And so Democrats spent, you know, the days and weeks after really hammering home on this point to try to paint her as out of touch with Iowa farmers and with the people who sent her into office in the first place.
So what is the shape of the race then between Ernst and Greenfield in this last day before the end of voting?
This has been a really close race. The Des Moines Register polls the Senate race pretty consistently throughout. And in June and in September, Teresa Greenfield, the Democrat, was about 3 points ahead of Joni Ernst. And that had held really steady through the summer and into the fall. And then we just released our very last poll of the cycle over the weekend. And that poll shows Joni Ernst ahead by 4 percentage points. And so that's not a giant lead. I don't know that she has pulled away, you know, for good. The rolling average of polling shows that this is still a very tight race. The rolling average shows her up by about 2 points. So I think most analysts are calling this one a toss-up still. Mm. This is a very tight race that could go either way. And I think a lot of people...
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, Brian, but can I just ask you one question about that poll that came out? Because a lot of politicos were watching that. And in terms of the presidential side of things in that Des Moines Register poll, mm-hmm. people were pointing to this massive 20-plus point swing in independence from Biden to Trump, and they were in 1 month, and they were wondering about the validity of that swing. Did you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So a little bit of background. We work with a pollster named Ann Selzer, and she's one of the best in the business, certainly the best in Iowa. And you know, for your listeners, you know, she's been out kind of on her own in some races in the past. In 2008, she saw the Barack Obama wave coming. In 2016, she accurately saw Trump winning Iowa when a lot of other people weren't, and kind of foresaw his lead in other Midwestern states. So this poll does have a history of seeing things where other people don't necessarily see them. But to your point on independence, we did see a pretty dramatic swing from September into this last poll. And really, independents are kind of a, you know, they're a fickle group of voters sometimes. But what we saw is really a coming home of Trump's base from 2016 to now. This is not a group of voters who have never been with the president. They helped put him into office, at least here in Iowa. You know, Trump carried independents by about the same margin that this poll shows him leading now. So what that may have been was people kind of feeling it out, waiting to see what happens, but in the end coming back to the president. So it does feel like a large swing. You know, our pollster reminds us that these are not the same independents that we polled in September. So you wouldn't necessarily expect to see the exact same behavior from these people. But one thing I would point to too is this poll does show not too many people undecided. But there is a group of people who say that they've already voted who just don't want to tell pollsters who they voted for. Mm-hmm. And so there is a little bit of movement. The overall top line numbers, neither candidate hits 50%. And so there's still a little bit of movement where we don't expect this to be the actual number on election night. But I think it does give us some insight for the presidential race and then also down ballot for the Senate race that the Trump base here in Iowa has come home a little bit for both of these Republican candidates.
Okay. So let's talk more specifically about Senator Ernst, because she was considered a rising star in the Republican Party. A handful of years ago gave the State of the Union response following a State of the Union address given by then President Barack Obama. So we actually got some voicemails from Iowa, Iowa voters calling to tell us specifically about their view of Senator Ernst. This is Matthew from Des Moines, and he actually told us why he's not voting for the senator this time around.
Joni Ernst, just like Donald Trump, has either been unwilling, unable, or both to grow into the role of U.S. Senator. Over the last 6 years, she has been a relentless advocate for corporate interests in oil, insurance companies, and big pharma. She has acted as their wholly owned subsidiary and has forgotten that Iowa is a purple state and not a deep red state.
That's Matthew from Des Moines. So, Brianne, what does the fact that this kind of response is coming from some voters in Iowa towards Ernst, telling us about sort of her position and the way the GOP has changed under President Donald Trump?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you go back to Joni Ernst's first run in 2014, you know, she rode this wave of Republicans going into the Senate, and she did it by really positioning herself as an outsider. She had this very viral campaign ad that drew on her experience as a farm girl castrating hogs. And she said, I'm going to go to Washington and make them squeal. And so that's a campaign promise that people have been looking to her for. Did she go in and, you know, shake things up? Did she hold people accountable even within her own party? Was she this kind of outsider maverick? And I think a lot of people look at her now as being arm in arm with this president, you know, occasionally willing to kind of, you know, chastise his rhetoric, but very rarely breaking with him or with the party in any major kind of way. You know, she voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act. I think voters like this are really looking at her time in office and saying, you know, did she live up to that promise that she made in 2014?
Interesting, Brianna, because I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, to what extent the campaign that she's running now, is she hitching her wagon to Donald Trump? Or is there some part of Joni Ernst's pitch to sort of more moderate voters in Iowa that she has that ability to be independent of the president? Or is she just all in with the president right now?
You know, I think she's trying to have it both ways a little bit. At a recent campaign stop that I went to for her, it looked like a Donald Trump rally. You know, you pulled up and there were Trump-Pence 2020 signs, Make America Great Again hats everywhere. It could have been a Donald Trump rally. She and the other people who spoke for her all spoke about how great the president is. She's appeared with him at rallies. She was just with him in Dubuque yesterday afternoon. You know, thanking him for how much he's done for Iowa. So she definitely has not shied away from appearing with this president. But at the same time, she is still trying to message, I think, to some of these more independent voters, women who are frustrated with the president, to say, I'm still willing to call him out when it needs to be done. I'm still my own person. I can only speak for myself. So I think there is a little bit of trying to walk that line and to have it both ways. But overall, I would say she has not shied away at all from hitching her wagon to this president.
And Brianne, I'm curious about how the vote count is going to unfold in Iowa. Do you expect to know an outcome tomorrow night, or are people going to have to wait a bit?
Well, you're talking to reporters who survived the Iowa 2020 caucuses this year, so I think we're all a little gun shy of saying everything will be perfect. But I think we're all mildly optimistic. Iowa county auditors are allowed to start kind of processing ballots early, you know, opening them and getting them ready to be counted. They can't actually start counting them until election day, but at midnight they can start doing that. So I think we're mildly optimistic that we'll have a pretty speedy result here in Iowa.
Well, Brianne Fannin-Steele is the chief politics reporter for the Des Moines Register with us from Des Moines, Iowa. Brianne, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Anthony, as we head, we got about a minute and a half before the break here. One of our listeners wanted to circle back to Maine and something that you said about Senator Collins' attempt to seek re-election in Maine. We got this message on Twitter from a person who calls themselves Norj Dan, who says that we postulated that Susan Collins is having problems with moderates because of polarization. I'm not sure that's correct. The listener says, I think she's having problems with moderates because she stopped voting like a moderate. Anthony, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, you can find criticism of Susan Collins based on her voting record, that her voting record is remarkably consistent with Republican orthodoxy, notwithstanding this reputation that she has had as a moderate. I don't have the numbers right in front of me in terms of how often she has voted with the president, but I have seen them over the months and years, and I know they're quite high. She's a pretty reliable vote in most cases, and yet she does have this reputation in the past of being this moderate who can work across party lines. So I think the listener is correct to bring that up.
Well, Anthony Brooks, hang on here. We are trying to get a sense about what's going to happen with the United States Senate as the balance of power there is up for grabs as well as the end of voting nears. Tomorrow in Election 2020, we're going to talk about Georgia when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we are looking at the Senate up for grabs, the balance of power there. And also, we're trying to think through this big question of what effect is the Senate going to have on governance in this country over the next 4 years. I'm joined today by Anthony Brooks. He's On Point's 2020 correspondent and senior political reporter for WBUR. And we're touching down in several states where the races are close. And before we move to Georgia here, Anthony, we were talking about how often Senator Susan Collins of Maine has been voting with the president, for example, with President Trump. And over the break, I just pulled up the numbers here because it's kind of interesting. These are from 538. And 538 says that in 2017 to 2018, Susan Collins voted with the president, with President Trump, 77% of the time. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, in 2019 to 2020, 538 says that number dropped to 45%. But the average of Susan Collins' votes as during the duration of President Trump's time in office is 67% with Donald Trump. So with those numbers in mind, just wanted to give you a chance to respond about that listener again saying that he didn't see Collins voting like a moderate anymore.
Well, I mean, you know, it depends just how you respond to that number. Mm-hmm. I mean, somewhere between 66 and 77%. I mean, the majority of the time Susan Collins has voted with President Trump. You know, I think what voters have come to terms with, though, is the most recent big stories. I mean, Collins, you know, lost lots of liberal and moderate support for her vote to confirm Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Her support for the tax bill, her refusal to denounce President Trump and her vote to acquit him in the Senate impeachment trial. Those were big mm-hmm. defining issues of the last year or two, I think. And so whatever her actual score is, I think for voters up in Maine, especially moderate voters, whom she used to do really well with, that has really pushed them away from her. And votes like that have really pushed them away from her.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, let's go now to talking about Georgia, which is going to be incredibly central to what happens with the Senate overall. Let's listen to what happened in last week's Senate debate in Georgia. Here's a moment where Democratic candidate John Ossoff attacked incumbent Republican Senator David Perdue for stock trades that Perdue made in the beginning of the pandemic and Perdue's stance on health care as well.
It's not just that you're a crook, Senator. It's that you're attacking the health of the people that you represent. You did say COVID-19 was no deadlier than the flu. You did say there would be no significant uptick in cases. All the while, you were looking after your own assets and your own portfolio, and you did vote four times to end protections for pre-existing conditions.
And here's Senator Perdue's response.
I voted against the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, because it was taking insurance away from millions of Georgians. Today, almost 18% of Georgians don't have any health insurance because of the Affordable Care Act. The next thing is, this is exactly what I'm talking about. He'll talk about anything except his own accountability and his own responsibility. He still hadn't owned up to the China accusation, which is in the public record.
So that's from a debate last week in Georgia. Joining us now is Tia Mitchell. She's Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tia, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So the Ossoff-Perdue race isn't the only one going on in Georgia right now. There's also a special election as well. So we have a special election and a general election for Senate in Georgia. First of all, can you explain that? What's going on?
Yes, that makes Georgia really rare that both of our Senate seats are on the ballot right now. Senator Johnny Isaacson was having some health ailments, and so he retired midterm. And so what that led to was two things. Brian Kemp appointed someone immediately to take Isaacson's place, and that's Senator Kelly Loeffler. But that also put the race on the ballot for, you know, this cycle for the remaining 2 years of Isaacson's term. And so Kelly Loeffler's running. But what happened was U.S. Representative Doug Collins, who, quite frankly, he and President Trump wanted Collins to be appointed to succeed Isaacson. When that didn't happen, Doug Collins said he was going to run anyways. So we have a very crowded special election, about 21 candidates, but multiple Democrats and Republicans, including, again, that incumbent Senator now Loeffler against Representative Doug Collins. And that's separate than the Perdue and Ossoff race, which is a more, you know, your normal general election race.
Okay. So let's start with that. The Ossoff-Perdue race, and then we'll come back to the special, because it could cause all sorts of curious outcomes in Georgia. Right now I'm seeing a Sunday poll from Emerson out of Georgia in the Perdue-Ossoff race that basically has Ossoff at 47 and incumbent Senator Perdue at 46. So extremely close there. Can you tell us why that is, Tia?
Yes, it's extremely close. You know, Perdue is very conservative. He is a former Fortune 500 CEO who kind of came in on that wave of outsider status that helped to pave the way for President Trump just a couple of years later. And so in that race, you have a more traditional Democrat who's a progressive and is campaigning on things like, you know, Obamacare, Medicaid expansion, criminal justice reform, and then you have a classic Trump conservative. The reason why neither have polled above 50% is there is a third party libertarian candidate who's, of course, polling in the single digits, but enough that in Georgia we have runoffs if neither candidate makes it to 50%. Mm. And so there is a likelihood that, again, if neither Ossoff nor Perdue, the incumbent, can get to 50%, that it will go to a runoff. And again, we know that special election with all those candidates is very likely to go to a runoff.
So, Tia, sorry, your line's kind of dropping in and out. So basically what you just said is both Senate races in Georgia right now, we should be prepared for both of them to go into a runoff, which would then leave the decision for January?
Yes. And that's why there's a lot of attention on Georgia, not just because both races are on the ballot, but because both races could be up in the air until January. And so if, you know, Democrats are hoping to win some seats and take control of the Senate, but if they need one or both of those Georgia seats to do so, then we may not know whether Democrats achieve that goal until after that January runoff.
I can only imagine, just Anthony, I'll let you jump in here in a second, but if that happens, I can only imagine the amount of money that will be poured into Georgia if there are still two Senate seats hanging in the balance for the beginning of 2021.
Yeah, and Tia, let me ask you about the Perdue-Ossoff race, because based on that polling, it's as you suggested, it's really quite possible that there's going to be a runoff. And I'm curious to get an understanding of what the dynamic of a runoff in Georgia would be like. In other words, who would it benefit? Who stands to do better in a runoff? Talk first about Perdue-Ossoff. Who's advantaged by that situation?
Well, generally speaking, Democrats have Georgia to get out the vote in runoffs. That's a general statement. However, I think it would bode better for Democrats if both Senate races are on the ballot, because that just gives voters even more of an incentive to come out. You're not just coming out and going through the lines and all of the things you have to do to vote one race. Now you have two. Again, also, because there will be so much attention, that runoff is scheduled for January 5th. I do think that somewhat negates, you know, the turnout issues that Democrats in runoffs. But still, you know, we know that Democratic voters tend to be the less reliable voters, and Democrats always, you know, have to work on turning out those voters who aren't as consistent, newer voters, people who, you know, are at all. And so that'll be a harder task for Democrats to explain, have to show up again in January. But the attention, and again, if both races are on the ballot, I think that'll even it up just a little bit.
Mm. Well, can you talk a little bit more, Tia, about the special election? Because you talked about Loeffler and Collins right now kind of splitting the Republican vote. Tell us about Warnock, who's polling at like roughly 37% in the special election right now.
Yes. So right now, when you look at the polls, Warnock is getting the most support, but that's because on the Democratic side, there are other Democrats in the race, but generally speaking, Democrats have coalesced around Warnock. He has the endorsement of, you know, people like Stacey Abrams and Barack Obama. And so, you know, it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that Reverend Warnock, who also, you know, he's a pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, that's Martin Luther King's old pulpit. So, you know, he just comes with a lot of support behind him and is very likely to be that Democrat who makes the runoff. So the question is, who will be the other candidate? And right now, Loeffler and Collins are polling neck and neck. Usually the polls show Loeffler is a little bit ahead. She not only has the power of the incumbency, but she has a big war chest of her own personal wealth. She's worth more than $500 million. Her husband is a founder of the company that owns the New York Stock Exchange. So she's lent her campaign $23 million. Her husband has spent millions more on and other organizations that are supporting her campaign. So she has a clear money advantage. However, what Collins has is that reputation of being Trump's chief defender in the U.S. House. He, until recently, was ranking member on the Judiciary Committee. So during impeachment, he was the one who was very visible, criticizing the Democratic-led impeachment of President Trump. So what they're both doing is really appealing to the right. They're trying to rally conservative voters. Each of them are trying to position themselves as the most conservative, the most Trump supporting candidate. And the question is, which one of them will be able to convince the most Republican voters in order to push them into the runoff?
So I've got one more question for you, Tia, because you talked about the importance of fundraising here. And also you talked about the importance of the get out the vote efforts. So can you tell us a little bit more about the role that Stacey Abrams is playing in these Senate races? Because, of course, she has been, you know, she's dedicated herself for the past couple of years to access to the ballot. So are her efforts making a difference, a measurable difference in Georgia?
I definitely think, particularly in the special election, because there were other Democrats, there was Ed Tarver, who's a former U.S. attorney. There's Matt Lieberman, whose father is Joe Lieberman. And so initially, Lieberman was polling even ahead of Warnock, because Warnock is, again, he's a pastor. He's never run for office before. But Stacey Abrams came out early in support of both Warnock and Ossoff. She has been campaigning for them for months. And so support from people like Stacey Abrams, who was still wildly popular, not only among Democrats in Georgia, but nationwide. And so Abrams put her stamp of approval on Warnock. I think that helped folks to consider him the candidate to back. And so it cannot be understated how instrumental Stacey Abrams is for Democrats and how bright of a future she has. You know, there's a lot of speculation about whether she's going to run for governor again. And she, of course, has spent the last couple of years since losing the race in 2018, building up various political organizations. She's got a lot of power and, quite frankly, a lot of money in her hands. Mm.
Well, Tia Mitchell is the Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, walking us through Georgia's dual Senate races right now, which neither one may be resolved until January of 2021. So, Tia, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Anthony, we've just got a couple of minutes left here, and I want to take a step back with you for just a moment, because no matter what happens, the Senate is going to be absolutely central to how governance is done in this country over the next 4 years. You can imagine a situation where there's opposing parties in the White House and in the Senate, and there will be continuous just gridlock. Or if there are matching parties, then perhaps there will be a lot of transformative change in whatever direction. But we can't talk about what's in the future for this country without knowing what the fate of the Senate's going to be.
Oh, it's a huge question that's going to begin to be answered tomorrow. I'd like to believe that we're going to know the answer to this by the end of the day tomorrow, but I don't think we are. I mean, one of the questions I'm interested in, Meghna, too, is let's assume that the Democrats take the Senate and Joe Biden wins. There's another sort of unresolved conflict that then begins to play itself out, and that is a sort of battle within the Democratic Party itself. I mean, right now, the Democratic Party is fairly united in opposing President Trump and doing everything it can to get Joe Biden into office. But then comes the sort of fight for the soul of the Democratic Party between the progressive wing and the more moderate wing. And that's something that I have a feeling, if Democrats win tomorrow, we're going to be talking about in the months ahead.
Well, Anthony Brooks is On Point's 2020 correspondent and senior political reporter for WBUR. Anthony, thank you as always.
Hey, it was a pleasure, Meghna. Talk to you tomorrow
or soon or every day for the next many weeks and months. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.